Hi, this is Brett, and I'm glad that you enjoy School Sucks Podcast. If you've been listening for a while and you find yourself learning and laughing, please consider becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to schoolsucks.podomatic.com to see all of the subscription tiers, or go to the support page on our website to just make a one-time donation. But if you can't afford to make a financial contribution, there's plenty of other ways to help. First, Facebook. Please like our School Sucks Facebook page. And once you do that, when you see School Sucks posts in your newsfeed, click like or comment or share them with your friends. It helps spread the word about the show. Second, Podomatic. Podomatic is the site that hosts our podcast feed. Rankings on Podomatic are also important to attract new listeners. When I post new shows, if you click on that link, it will take you to a Podomatic page. From there, you can like the podcast, comment on the podcast, and share it with your friends on just about any social networking site that you can imagine. Third, Twitter. Follow us on Twitter. People seem to like Twitter. And last but certainly not least, YouTube is the best option we have available right now for reaching a wider and younger audience. Please go to YouTube. It is YouTube.com/user/School Sucks Podcast and subscribe to our channel. Thank you, first of all, for thinking. Second of all, for listening. And third, for your support. Please go to schoolsucksproject.com or schoolsucks.podomatic.com to learn more. Everybody, this is Brett, and welcome back to School Sucks Podcast for January 15th, 2012. And a couple of days ago, on Friday, I had the pleasure of being a co-host on the Pork Therapy Live show with Stephanie Murphy. We covered a fairly wide range of subjects, but one of the things that we talked about was a recent experience that I had with a student, homeschool, unschool student, really, who has, this very self-directed educational environment that I just kind of consider myself a contributor to. And, you know, he's very interested in history and mythology and even pseudoscience, like UFOs and mythical creatures and stuff like that. So it's been a good opportunity for me to have, for lack of a better word, teachable moments as far as like how to make convincing arguments, how to use logic. This is only a 9-year-old, but he understands these things very well and has actually, you know, backed off a lot of his more far-fetched conspiracy type theories. Very into the Illuminati right now, which is a real thing. Much more real than, of course, the Hollow Earth, which was something that he used to be into. But he certainly is capable of, you know, reasoning through and looking at the facts and changing what he believes. So all in all, this is a very enriching experience for me as an educator or a facilitator. And like I said, I'm really just there to kind of complement what he wants to do. And of course, this has been arranged with the school that could not serve him as his education. So this has been a mutually beneficial thing for all parties involved. And I really enjoy working with this young man. Last week, he told me that he wanted to start trying to make a stop-action Lego animation movie with a pirate theme. And I was surprised that I even let it get as far as it did for me. And it only lasted about 5 minutes. But I became very overzealous and very over-enthusiastic about my desire to help. And I think that came across to him is that I was taking control of the project. We had a conversation about the script, and I gave some input a little bit too forcefully. And like I said, I don't want any of the glory that might come with making a Lego pirate movie. But you know, I felt like I was trying to be helpful, but I really blew it. It really backfired on me because his reaction or his assessment of my behavior was that I was taking over and it had become too complicated, and he didn't want to be involved anymore. Because I think what I did was I inadvertently moved him away from the joy and the satisfaction of the smaller tasks that he was really enjoying. And I said, okay, we got to look at the big picture. We got to look at all this at once. And that was just too much all at once. And it kind of sabotaged his interest in the whole project. And maybe that wasn't important. Like I said on Pork Therapy, maybe the whole big picture thing wasn't important. Maybe we just should have gotten whatever learning we could or whatever enrichment for him and satisfaction for him we could out of the individual components of a what might have turned out to be a larger project. So also on Pork Therapy, I talked about how this got me thinking about the I don't hate to use a word like suffering that most kids endure for 35 to 40 hours a week in these government schools. I mean, this is even true in any institutionalized schooling, especially for young kids who I see what happens when I become a little bit too top down, a little bit too, in this child's eyes anyways, authoritarian for like 5 minutes and how it just saps his whole interest in this project. And, you know, his creativity and his enthusiasm. Now, imagine not 5 minutes of that, 35 hours a week of that, what that would do to a young person's enthusiasm and creativity and curiosity where they never have any input at all. It's not just like, whoa, in this collaboration, you're having a little bit too much input, teacher. They have no input. They just have tasks that maybe they understand and maybe they don't, that are given to them to complete. So this got me thinking, this whole experience, and talking about it, and really calling myself out about it, because like I said, I blew it. I was able to, you know, back off and correct this mistake, but it got me thinking about an article that I had read recently on a Psychology Today blog written by Peter Gray called Freedom to Learn. I'll put a link to this blog in the show notes. I'd like to have Peter Gray on the show eventually. He has done an interview with Stefan Molyneux on Free Domain Radio, so I encourage you to go check that out. But here he's talking about a book written by Dr. Kirsten Olson, and the title of this book is Wounded by School, Recapturing the Joy in Learning and Standing Up to Old School Culture. And I want to read this article, and she outlines 7 ways that the institution of school hurts young people. And I thought it would also be helpful if I added some of my own experience, not from being a student, but maybe my observations from working as a teacher in the past. Because really, any teacher that has the ability to do some introspection, and I would even say the courage to do some introspection when you think about some of the things that we do as teachers. There's wounds for us too, or there should be, you know, if we're capable of being honest. I know that I certainly feel that way about some of the things that I've been involved in the past. You know, some of it very haunting that I talked about, I think a little bit in the Children of the State series. The title of this blog entry, How Does School Wound? Kirsten Olson has counted some ways. Like I said, I'm going to read this and I'll color it with my own experience a little bit. Let me introduce you to Dr. Kirsten Olson. She is an educational researcher, activist consultant, and writer deeply concerned about children learning and the conditions of our schools. She is, among other things, the president of the board of directors of IDEA, the Institute for Democratic Education in America. I met her for the first time for lunch and conversation a couple weeks ago. Then I eagerly read her latest book, Wounded by School, Recapturing the Joy in Learning and Standing Up to Old School Culture. If you've ever gone to school or have a child in school or might have a child in school someday or care about children in school, I recommend her book to you. Wounded by School is the outcome of research that Olson began when she was an educational doctoral candidate at Harvard. As one who loves learning and has always had high esteem for education, Olson intended to conduct research into the delights and enlightenment experienced in the course of schooling. But when she began interviewing people to learn about such positive effects, she found that they talked instead about the pain of school. Here's how Olson's doctoral advisor, Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, put it in a foreword to the book. In her first foray into the field, in-depth interviews with an award-winning architect, a distinguished professor, a gifted writer, a marketing executive, Olson certainly expected to hear stories of joyful and productive learning, stories that mix seriousness, adventure, and pleasure, work and play, desire and commitment. Instead, she discovered shadows of pain, disappointment, even cynicism in their vivid recollections of schooling. Instead of the light that she expected, she found darkness. And their stories did not merely refer to old wounds, now healed and long forgotten. They recalled deeply embedded wounds that still bruised and ached. Wounds that still compromised and distorted their sense of themselves as persons and professionals. As her project expanded, Olson began interviewing people of all ages, from school children on up to grandparents, people from a wide range of socioeconomic backgrounds and occupying a wide variety of careers. She was struck by the earnestness and emotion that came forth as people talked about the wounds they still felt in relation to their schooling. Olson was pioneering a direct way to understand the effects of school on psychological development. She asked people who had been there how school affected them. In her book, Olson categorizes the wounds into seven groups, and she illustrates each with quotations from interviews. Then in later chapters, she describes how parents, teachers, and students themselves can help prevent and heal these wounds. Here, I'll simply list and describe in my own words, Olson's seven categories. I've added my own twist to the description of each type of wound, so if you find fault with the descriptions, the faults may be mine rather than Olson's. The first four categories of wounds all seem to result primarily from the restrictions that are placed on students' behavior in learning in school, the preset curriculum, the narrow set of permissible learning procedures, the tests in which there's one right answer for every question, and the often arbitrary rules that students have no role in creating. The categories are, number one, wounds of creativity. School stifles creativity. This is perhaps the most obvious wound of school. Students' own passions and interests are generally ignored. Students' unique, creative ways of solving problems and their outside-the-box answers to questions, which fail to match the teacher's answer sheets, are not understood and are graded as wrong by busy teachers. Rote learning and tests that have one right answer for every question leave no room for creativity. Olson's informants, who went on to live creative lives, apparently did so despite, not because, of schooling. They had to recover or rebuild the creative spirit that had been so natural to them before starting school. My own guess is that altogether, too many others rarely think about creativity once they have lost it in school. They may not even notice this wound. And then there are those who remain creative in those realms which school does not touch, but become uncreative in realms covered by the school curriculum. How many people have totally lost mathematical creativity because of the ways it was taught in school? This is a really good point, because I think too often when we use the word creativity, people are just thinking about, you know, music and painting. And creativity and problem solving, of course, is very, very important. And I might have mentioned this on the show a couple times in the past, but like when I first entered the professional world a little more than 10 years ago, the catchphrase was think outside the box. Like this was some kind of new thing, like a new way to deal with problems is to think about them differently. Like, this was revolutionary. Like, we look back at the past, and every major advancement that moved our civilization forward was a result of people who think outside of this box. But when I entered the professional world around the year 2000, this was like a new concept. It was like something that had to be reintroduced to us, because we learn about the innovation and the heroism of all these people like Einstein, but we're never taught. And it's certainly, whether it's explicit or implicit, we never believe that those are things that we could do ourselves. School takes all of that out of us. It's like, in some cases, creativity results in disciplinary action. When I was teaching history and I was challenged about some of the things that I was teaching, even though that I thought that I was like real cutting edge, I remember like being irritated with certain students because they were derailing things. And maybe, no, I think I did improve. Like when I was new and I was first getting my feet wet, this was very scary because I wanted to show that I could manage the classroom and get students to perform. And I mean, I was like that in the beginning. And then I think that I welcomed some of these derailments. But if you're not thinking creatively, or that creativity in your thinking processes has been stripped out of you, you become a teacher and you're looking at state curriculum standards, and you're kind of being guided by the state-approved textbooks, you're not going to be creative in your thinking as far as challenging the information that's in those books. I mean, every teacher that I ever had when I was a student, and most of the teachers that I worked with and I worked around when I was a teacher, taught this way. And why so much trust in the textbooks? I think that takes us to number two, wounds of compliance. In school, students must continuously follow rules and procedures that they have no role in creating and must complete assignments that make no sense in terms of their own learning needs. Students generally cannot question these rules and assignments. If they do, they are smart alecks or worse. To avoid getting in trouble, they learn to obey blindly, and in the process, they learn to be bad citizens in a democracy. Democracy requires citizens who question the rules and insist on changing those that are unfair or don't make sense. I'll keep going. I think insert a number of comments right there. They also hurt themselves by going through life following narrower paths than they might if school had not taught them that it is dangerous to explore the edges. Well, I mean, that certainly explains the perpetuation of this problem that I was just talking about with teachers. And sometimes it can be like, I still feel a little uneasy when I'm talking to new people, like face to face. It's easy to do it this way. But when I'm trying to introduce some of my ideas to new people, that kind of like walking on eggshells feeling. Because this word, I was driving yesterday and this word, like, thought about telling this stuff to somebody new, and then this word came to my mind, crusader, right? Oh, well, you're some kind of crusader, you know? For all this talk about people wanting change or people identifying problems within the system, and of course, this think outside the box, like, if you really start applying those things to institutions that people are extremely comfortable with, that doesn't go well. And for me, this was the number one lesson of school. Obedience is a virtue. Number three, you see how these are related, wounds of rebellion. Some students respond to the arbitrary rules and assignments by rebelling rather than complying. They may in some cases feel intense anger towards the system that has taken away their freedom and dignity, toward teachers who seem to be complicit with that system, and toward the goody-goody students who go along. They may manifest their scorn by sitting in the back of the classroom, making snide remarks, blatantly flouting rules, and rarely, if ever, completing assignments. Rebellion may sometimes be a healthier response than compliance, but if it goes too far, it may even hurt more than compliance. Failure in school may cut off valued future paths. Anger towards schooling can lead to a turning away from all forms of learning, and perhaps most tragically, the rebellions can take forms that physically harm the self and others, especially if the person turns to drugs, promiscuous sex, and crimes as forms of self-expression and self-identity. Oh, so true. And two and three, wounds of compliance and wounds of rebellion, really go together so well. I got together with some family yesterday, and my brother was talking about how his stepson is not performing very well in school. And my first comment was, and I said it kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but I was serious. Well, you should go. He has to go in and meet with the teacher on Monday. And this kid, who's very, very bright and very, very interested in a lot of things, failed social studies, which is like history, kind of. And I said, you know, you should go in and you should ask the teacher, well, you know, this boy is smart and has no problem learning at home. What do you think that you're doing wrong that has him failing your social studies class? And people didn't think that that was a good approach because, of course, we know. I mean, when I was growing up, my father was the chairman of the school board, and he had ridiculous ideas for these teachers, like they should be paid based on their performance. And so I had kind of this black mark on me because of that. And teachers didn't like me because of who my father was. Anyway, that's another story, maybe for another time. But the feedback was, well, that will just get him in more trouble. If you go in there and give the teacher a hard time, like, you know, the teacher might just take it out on the student because they're probably not going to stand up to a parent, from my experience anyway. So I was so bothered by the whole conversation, like something is wrong. The people in the conversation, it's like the language is so subtle, but like it just jumps out at me now when I hear it. What's the problem, you know, that this boy is having? What's this boy's problem? Well, this boy doesn't have a problem. And I said to the adults there, I said, if you are forced into 8 hours a day of some kind of insurance seminar where you're not paid and you have no control, we're not going to, and then you come and talk about how you don't like it or you're not doing what's asked of you. No one's going to talk about it being a problem with you. It's not a problem with you. So even like, I understand how rebellion can lead to turning away from learning in general. That's, of course, very important. And, you know, maybe winding up in, certainly for me, a crowd of people who weren't, I don't want to say the best influence, but people who were engaging in destructive behaviors. And when you hang out with people who do destructive things and then you start doing them, you're only going to isolate more and more into that group because you know that behavior is destructive, but the people you hang around with make it look normal. And this doesn't even address teenage depression, teenage suicide, all kind of, I think, either results of wounds of compliance or wounds of rebellion. Number four. Now, I just want to go back and I want to point out that the first four categories of wounds all seem to result primarily from the restrictions that are placed on students' behavior and learning in school. So number four, wounds of numbness. The constant grind of school, doing one tedious assignment after another according to the school schedule, following school procedures, can lead to intellectual numbness. Many of Olson's respondents describe themselves as zoned out or intellectually numb as long as they were in school. Intellectual excitement is rarely rewarded in school, but doggedly grinding it out, doing what you're supposed to do, never missing a deadline, is rewarded. Brilliant work in one subject at the expense of ignoring another might earn you an A and an F in the two classes, but good enough, non-inspired work in both subjects might earn you an A in both. This is one of the many ways by which schooling kills intellectual enthusiasm. When students do demonstrate enthusiasm, it is usually about something that has nothing to do with their lessons. So I'll stop there. We're going to split this into two parts. Yeah, my experience, not so much as a teacher, maybe a little bit as a teacher, but really as a tutor, when I was having real breakthroughs with young people, when we were really excited about something and they were really engaged, it was always a derailment from what we were supposed to be doing for their schoolwork. And I talked about this in a show a couple years ago called Working Against Apathy, which I saw as part of my job to point out to young people that there is a big difference between schooling and education. There's a big difference between institutionalized schooling and learning. And do not give up your enthusiasm or do what you can to reclaim your enthusiasm for learning. Don't let school sabotage it, because it will. It did for me. Like, I graduated from high school in 1995. I was 17. I hated school. I didn't want to go to college. And I went through college and I kind of B minus and C plus my way through for a couple years. No idea what I wanted to do. I didn't care about anything. And then I think it was when I was a junior and I discovered history that everything turned around. And this enthusiasm was ignited for the first time since I was like 6 or 7 years old. And I remember, like, I actually had a really good first grade teacher. And I remember I had trouble reading and writing and spelling initially. And so I would write, we had that big yellow lined paper, which had like the little dotted line through the two big lines. So it taught you how to do like upper and lowercase penmanship. And when I couldn't, I would create like these comics kind of where part of it would be writing, but then if I didn't know how to spell a word, or I would try to sound out words, but like, I want to make sure this is accurate. Was I really this conscious of it? I knew if I had no idea how to spell a word, it was kind of futile. I didn't use that word in my head when I was six, but I knew it was kind of futile to try and sound it out if I just had no idea where to start. So this is like learning to read and write. So I would draw a picture, and I would create these like, you know, comic book kind of papers where it would be words and a picture and then words and a picture and so on and so forth. And my teacher loved this. She thought it was great. And instead of me like scolding me for doing this, you know, she would say, oh, this is great. And she would write little things and, you know, you get the stickers, not that stickers are good, but, and she would just, enthusiastically approve of what I was doing and just write the spelling of the word under my picture. And, the next time that I had an experience that positive, with an instructor, I was 20.
And before we wrap up today, I think it would also be worth talking about some ways to deal with these wounds, obviously. And some of the things that I've tried to do in my own professional experience, really more with what I've done in the last few years as a tutor, to heal some of this stuff. Well, first of all, I think it's probably worth spending a few minutes on prevention. When it comes to creativity and individuality and avoiding that numbness, all of the things that Kirsten talked about in this article, the best advice that I can give to parents or teachers or any kind of educational facilitator in any environment is, and I know this is hard. I mean, if you're a public school teacher, like you're expected to have your hands on stuff in a certain way. But the best advice I can give to parents is get out of the way. Right? Like what's the problem? The problem is that you're in the way of a natural process, that school is in the way of a natural process. I mean, if you look around our society, and especially during a presidential campaign, and you see people explaining things and describing things and calling things like the polar opposite of what they actually are, it shouldn't be so hard to believe that the same is true with education, public education. It's not education. So, like I said, I've worked with kids who are just about at the end of this wounding process of government schooling. And I do this mostly. I don't do, at least for the last 6 months or so, I haven't done much of that firefighter type tutoring where kid has bad grades, come fix grades kind of, mission. Most of it has been SAT. So one of the things that I do in these SAT classes is I encourage, and this is the term I use, breaking rules. I encourage people to break rules. Let me give you an example of like an SAT math problem where rules can be broken, right? Because sometimes it's just a simple, stupid rule in real life, not in an SAT math problem, but sometimes it's just some stupid, simple rule that hasn't been reevaluated, that might have been made in a time where, you know, it's no longer relevant, that's creating an obstacle to do what you want or to solve some kind of problem that needs to be solved. So I always introduce this in the class as this is a practice that Albert Einstein was very fond of. Albert Einstein, kind of the go-to creative genius, example. Einstein became more than a patent clerk because he had the courage to look at well-established conventions that people had not questioned in a long time, pretty much, the work of, in his case, Isaac Newton, and said, well, why are we so sure about this? What if we break these rules? What happens? And that pushed the science of quantum physics forward, quite a bit. Physics in general, I guess you could say. So, like, picture this. Picture an SAT math problem where you have what looks like a pie slice, a piece of pizza, right? So it's circular on the outside edge, and then it's sort of the rest of it looks like you know, kind of like a triangle. Like a, you can picture a piece of pizza. I maybe I don't need to explain that anymore. And the problem says the angle from the center, from the most narrow point, is 30 degrees, and the arc, the outside where the crust is, measures 6 pi. What is the area of the sector of this circle? And students become maybe a little frustrated and a little apprehensive about approaching a problem like this because they've never been taught a formula for the area of a sector of a circle. Yeah, you could create a formula for that, but most students, and I found in my experience, don't know how to find the area of the sector of a circle. And because most of these students learn in this factory labor environment where you're given a problem, you have a formula, you put them together and produce a solution, very little thinking required. It's all just computation. When you know what to do, please do the same thing over and over again for 30 times tonight instead of doing what you want to do with your free time, that kind of a thing. From my experience, a lot of students are uncomfortable with this because they've always thought of math as just, you know, applying formulas to problems and involving very little complex reasoning and not working through problems in a series of steps that incorporate a variety of different mathematical concepts. So to solve this problem, this is actually somewhat time consuming because you have to, well, this is a sector of a circle. So what do I know about circles? Well, I know that there's 360 degrees in a circle. I know the formula for finding the circumference of a circle is pi times diameter. And I know the formula for finding the area of a circle is pi r squared. So that's my previous knowledge about this. Now what I'm being told is I have a sector of a circle, which is 30 degrees. And the outside of the circle, the arc on the outside measures 6 pi. The crust on this slice measures 6 pi. So what I need to do now is treat this for a moment like a whole circle of which I have 30 degrees. So 30 over 360 is 1/12. So I'm looking at 1/12 of a circle. Now, if I know I'm looking at 1/12 of a circle and the outside arc is 6 pi, I know that the 6 pi represents 1/12 of the circle's circumference. So now I know that the circle's circumference is 72 pi. If circumference is pi times diameter and the circumference of this circle is 72 pi, I now know that the diameter of the circle is 72, which means the radius of the circle is 36. From there, I can do the area formula, 36 squared times pi, and arrive at 1,296 pi. And then I divide that by 12, and I know the area of this sector. Now, it doesn't happen that fast for most people. I've done that problem before. So, but that's time consuming. And at every step, you might have to stop and say, okay, what do I do next? What do I know? What new information have I gathered? And where can I go from here? So the breaking of the rule is I say, well, you know, when you're given pictures on the SAT, unless it says this picture is not drawn to scale, you can assume that it's drawn to scale and you can trust the visual information to make estimations. So sometimes you could just, like, if you know the arc is 6 pi, that's about 18. So how long do the two sides, the other sides of that shape look? Well, they're about twice that. All right, well, let's call them 35. And now an arc, here's the breaking of the rule, of a circle looks like a triangle. So you might not know the formula for the arc of a circle, or a sector, excuse me, you might not know the formula to find the area of a sector of a circle, but you know the formula for the area of a triangle, 1/2 base times height. So just break the rule that it's a sector and treat it like a triangle. And you might not get the exact answer, but the test is multiple choice. So the answer that's closest is going to be, you know, to what you came up with is going to be the one you should pick. I mean, that's just a simple example of where a rule can be broken, and then put the rule back in and, you know, get the right answer to the problem. I'll give you another example real quick. Now, I pick these examples because they welcome this kind of rule breaking. These are some problems that I actually do in the class. The sum of 5 consecutive numbers is 1,000. What is the largest of these numbers? Now, most of the SAT word problems are asking people to take that information and turn it into an equation which they can solve. The problem is equations or algebra usually involves one unknown. Once you get into systems, maybe, you know, two unknowns. But when you have five unknowns, people, that's intimidating, I think, for person with, you know, basic algebra knowledge. So break the rule that the numbers are consecutive. Let's say all the numbers are the same. Well, that's easy. Five numbers that add up to 1,000, if they're all the same, they're all 200. Now put the rule back in. They have to be consecutive. So you just stagger them around 200. So one of the 200s becomes 199. The one from there goes over to the other side. That number becomes 201. You take two from one of the other 200s, make it 198, and put that two on the other one, and it's 202. So there's five consecutive numbers, the largest of which is 202. And then, you know, I'll say no great advancements were ever made by people following stupid old rules. I understand that solving SAT math problems is rarely going to lead to great advancements, but I think I try to put in these examples where I can just to get people. I mean, this is like things that, like sometimes the looks in the faces in this class is like, wow, that was actually kind of cool. You know, like there's some satisfaction all of a sudden with math. So I'm really proud of that. See, people want to know things. People are frustrated by mystery, obviously. Unfortunately, our curiosity is sabotaged and wounded in school because there's too much frustration involved in the path from mystery to knowing. And there's no reward. Wait a minute, Brett, are you saying that there should be rewards? No, I'm saying there should be intrinsic rewards. There's no intrinsic reward for doing anything in school. So one of the problems with this government schooling is that it's not in touch with the needs of the learner, right? You're doing things just because. So there's no intrinsic motivation to do any of this stuff. And I think a lot of times that sabotages interest in things that could be very interesting and very satisfying. I hated math. In school, and even when I started tutoring, because of my experience in math, in school, I moved to Massachusetts in 2006 and started working for this tutoring company. And I said, I've been a history teacher, and I had actually taught math, but it was pretty remedial in this private school. It was like basic algebra. I said, I'm not comfortable tutoring the SAT math. I'm not good at math. I'm actually great at math. And I never would have known it if I hadn't, you know, gotten back into this this SAT math as a tutor. And I love it. I was down in New Jersey a while ago and visiting with a family where one of the girls was in high school. Show me what you're doing in math, I said. I really like math. But I never would have known that if my only experience had been in public school. And why did I get interested in math? Because I had a personal incentive. I could get more work if I knew how to do this stuff. I went on to actually tutor I'm not reading my resume here, but I went on to tutor the SAT subject area test in math, and I knew none of that stuff, but so many people wanted it that I went and I learned it. And the first time I tutored a student, I was really scared because there was, like, I was still not to the expertise where I wanted to be as a tutor, and everything turned out fine. So I went back and I hit the books again. The next student I tutored got a perfect score, 800 out of 800 on this, and that was like, it was great. Math. I like math. And some of you might be saying, Brett, you're wrong, because school introduces such a wide variety of subject areas to students, which it does. Unfortunately, it makes most of them seem like they could only be agonizing. But I mean, we have art and gym and music, and I mean, all these things maybe for a lot of people are introduced in school. But the problem is, I think that there's a certain amount of frustration that goes along with maybe becoming passionate about one of those things while trying to work on the public school schedule. Because if you're introduced to music in school and you just become so passionate and in love with music, can you reprioritize your whole schedule? Can you go to your little guidance counselor and say, all right, we're dropping math. Don't need it. We are dropping this chemistry. Yuck and dumb. Never going to use that. We're going to reallot that time for me to work on my greatest passion, which is music. It's not happening. It even said in the article that I just read that, you know, school's this interesting place where if you do really inspired and brilliant work in one subject, you might wind up with an F in another. And no one is going to be like, oh, yeah, F, whatever, because look at this brilliant work that you did in music class or on this history project. No, the focus is going to be on the F. What's wrong with you? You're getting an F in frigging chemistry. So in some ways, I think that that's even more dangerous and more frustrating. And if you're still a little bit incredulous about that, and you say, Brett, people can, you know, handle all of the expectation and all of the rigorous demands of their school schedule and still do great things, you know, on top of that. Sure. People can go to the moon. People can win the lottery. Most people don't. And as far as, like, you know, contributions, some of the greatest contributions to our civilization were made by people when they were very young. But most of those things happened before that all young people, now up until the age of like 22, were expected to be in institutionalized school all day. So most people just give up on this stuff and they don't care about it at all and they just rather skip it entirely. So if you can find a way to make these kinds of problems engaging, it gets that thinking going again. And, you know, I try to do that as much as I can. I hope that's a good example of what we're talking about, because that deals with, you know, the creativity applied to problem solving. It deals with the compliance, because you're saying, let's not do this the way we're supposed to do this. And it also kind of deals with the numbness, because I think that it's an engaging way to approach a problem. Now, in an actual school environment, another thing that I think is an obstacle, and I find this just in the class, I think I said this to Stephanie on Pork Therapy, that I know when I explain certain things that somebody has questions, but rarely do people ask questions about things that are mathematical. I've generated a couple good conversations when we're talking about essay writing or topics for essay writing, but it's a little bit more difficult to get people to open up about whatever difficulties they have in math in the group because they spend 35 hours a week in these environments where there's a lot of judgment. And I think that one of the things that if you work in a school, if you're a teacher, trying to remove the stiffness and the judgment from the environment, like, welcome stupid ideas. You know what I'm saying? Like, no brilliant idea when the person first said it sounded like everyone was like, whoa, that's brilliant. No, they're like, that's stupid. I would never, how does a carriage move without a horse hooked up to the front of it? You nitwit. So, like, brilliant ideas, really revolutionary ideas, will probably sound pretty stupid or crazy when they're first introduced. So one of the things that I tried to do with problem solving is, like, let's look at some stupid ways to try and solve this. I've done this with high school kids. I did this at the Scholars Academy with kids who were between, like, 7 and 10. And they loved it. The young kids did. Some of the older kids I found are a little bit more jaded. But they don't have to be if the environment's right. Now, obviously, in 10 hours of an SAT class, sometimes these classes are just 4 hours. It's very hard for me to get them comfortable with a whole new environment after they have been, you know, in the government school system for between 10 and 12 years. And the only other thing that I want to talk about today, some of the work that I do with this this younger boy that we started out talking about at the beginning of the show. He spent 2 years in public school where he was terrorized with math, right? Because that's not where his interest or his productive energy lied, but he was forced to do it. So now, ta-da, he hates math. And there's no timetable. There's no schedule as far as my work with him for learning math. When his interests go that way, I know that, you know, the reality of the situation is that periodically I have to report to the school about what we're doing, and they want to see all these subject areas covered. So I try to take the opportunities where they are created for me by the interests of this student. So he was very into Google Earth. And he liked to bookmark places on Google Earth that might be secret government bases. This kid's awesome. So, and like UFO sites. So like starts with Area 51, which for some reason you can see on Google Earth. And Groom Lake, which are these supposedly like these conspiracy-oriented sites where weird crap goes on. The Denver Airport, that's another big one. But you can look at these things from satellite pictures on Google Earth. So I started teaching him about GPS and how he could find these different locations. Like Google Earth has this thing where you can just put like a little safety pin looking thing on locations that you want to save. And it was a great way for us to get into GPS. Right? Which is not like maybe the math that he should be learning at that age. Should in quotes. But it's getting him comfortable again with at very least numbers. Another thing we did was Monopoly. He had never played before, and he had Simpsons Monopoly, which was pretty cool. And, you know, I don't want to say I was letting him win, because I think that's a little bit dishonest and, you know, kind of underestimating him. So I wasn't being, let's just say, I wasn't being as ruthless as I could have been. I wasn't being as 1%. As I could have been with my approach to the whole Monopoly game. And he loved it. He loved going pass and go, getting $200, you know, counting it out. And by trying to do mathematical things earlier in working with him, he was very standoffish, very apprehensive, very uncomfortable with anything that had to do with math. But by having a fun way to do it, was much more open to the idea and liked, you know, counting out. And turns out he could do this stuff. He just had such a negative experience with it in school that he was, like I said, afraid and reluctant because of the force that had been applied when he was in first and second grade. So we'll talk more in the second part of this. I'll go over the next three wounds of school. And I hope this was helpful. Thanks for listening, and take care.